Hi, this is Doug Kay, co-host of All About the Gear, and I want to let you know that I still have a few slots open for my street photography workshops in Havana, Cuba, November 2016 and January 2017. If you'd like to join me in Cuba and get to know the people of Havana and the streets of Havana, head on over to dougkaye.com/workshops. That's dougkaye.com/workshops, and I hope to see you there. And up next on the TWIP Network, Gordon Lang and I review the Panasonic Lumix GX85/GX80 on All About the Gear. Hello, this is Doug Kay. I'm here once again with Gordon Lang, and we've got a great new camera to look at today. It is the Lumix GX85. I think I got that right, Gordon. How are you?
I'm good, Doug. How are you? I should say that from my location in the United Kingdom, we actually call it the Lumix GX80. So throughout this review, I'll be using the standard that I've done in my review at cameralabs.com, where I'll be referring to it as the Lumix GX80 or GX85. So it's going to be twice as long.
And we've discussed some of these things. For some reason, Panasonic/Lumix has the most complicated and confusing nomenclature for their cameras. We're not going to get into it again. Every time it comes up, I have to go back and look at my notes because I can never remember what the lineage of these cameras is, because now there are so many cameras that either have been in production or are still in production. It's crazy. Okay. So let's take a look at it. Thanks to Panasonic in the U.S., I have a camera in my hands. I have to admit, I have not spent much time with it, but Gordon, you got a chance to evaluate it very thoroughly.
Yes, I've been shooting with it for a few weeks now. My sample has gone back to Panasonic UK, but I have finished my tests with it. So I'm very familiar and I'm very much looking forward to telling you all about it. If it looks familiar to any Panasonic fans out there, it's because the body is very much based on the earlier Lumix GX7. It's a flat top design, as you can see. So the viewfinder is perched in the corner rather than a kind of DSLR styled hump in the middle, like the G7 and the GH4 in Panasonic's range. Now, you may or may not like this. There are pros and cons to them, which I'll tell you about in a moment. But really, it's a personal choice. Do you like a viewfinder hump at the top, or do you like one perched in the corner in this flat-topped style? And I'll put it to you, Doug Kay, which style do you prefer?
You know, I actually prefer this style with the EVF in the corner, simply because it makes the cameras a bit smaller. Of course, you give up something for that. I'm not sure what you give up in this case. But sometimes it changes the location of the flash. It changes a few things around.
Are you a left eye or a right eye?
I am a left eye shooter.
Me too. Yeah. So do you not find then that the nose gets in the way of the screen and prods it?
You know, it's not a problem for me because very few of my cameras have touch-sensitive screens. What does happen when I review a touch-sensitive screen camera is that if I'm in a mode where the touch is active, sure enough, the nose will come in, it'll change the focus, it'll do all sorts of things. But generally, it's not a problem with the gear I use.
Well, we'll get that out of the way right now. As you know, I'm a big fan of touch-sensitive screens, and as a Lumix camera, Panasonic are also big fans of touch screens. So the GX80-85 that you have there also has a touch screen. And because it has the viewfinder in the corner, and because I compose with my left eye, yes, I do inevitably touch the touch screen with my nose. And you can move the AF area with your nose while you're composing through the viewfinder if you want. Now, you can turn that off. The idea was that you could actually use the touch screen while you compose through the viewfinder to move the AF area, which is actually really handy. But if you accidentally keep touching it, you can switch that feature off. However, I should add that I did become quite adept at repositioning the AF area with my nose deliberately.
I thought about
that. Just lean forward and peck it like a manic bird.
You know, the problem is you have to do things like this and like this. Okay, that's an extreme use case. There you go.
But we'll talk more about the touchscreen later because okay. Panasonic has really embraced it. It's not just about moving the AF area. It's used in loads of different ways. We'll come to that in a minute. I mean, going back to the design, so it is a flat-topped camera. The compromise, or rather, let's look at the pro first. The pro of the flat-top camera is that it is flat on the top. It is flush. Everything's flush. So there's nothing prodding out the top to take up more space in your bag. However, it does mean that unless you have a viewfinder that pops up from within the body, for example, Sony's RX100 series, it means that the viewfinder physically is positioned on top of the screen. Now, if you've got a 4x3 shaped screen or a 3x2 shaped screen and a normal viewfinder perched on top of that, you need a certain height to accommodate that. If you want that camera to be shorter, something has to give. Either the viewfinder or the screen has to be narrower, shorter. And in the case of Sony's A6000 and A6300 that we talk a lot about on this show, they went for a 16x9 shaped screen. Great for video, annoying for stills. It's the one thing I really actually dislike about that camera, although it did have a 4x3 shaped viewfinder. On the GX80, GX85, similarly to the GX7 before it, the compromise is in the viewfinder. So the screen is 3x2 shaped, so it's good for stills and video. The viewfinder is 16x9 shaped. That's quite unusual. And even though I've not had it officially confirmed, I personally believe it is simply to accommodate that body shape. If it was a 4x3 viewfinder, it would actually be several millimeters taller. Now, a 16x9 viewfinder or screen is brilliant when you're composing or playing back HD video or 4K video. It fills the panel. It looks absolutely fantastic. However, for stills, you're not going to be using portions down the left and right sides, unless we forget Micro Four Thirds, which this camera is based on, natively shoots in a 4x3 shaped aspect ratio, which is squarer than most other formats. That means that the borders down the side of that 16x9 viewfinder, they're really thick. There's large portions that are not used. As a consequence, the active image that you look at when you're composing a picture through the viewfinder or playing one back is noticeably smaller and obviously uses less of the pixels than rival viewfinders. So for me, that is the big failing of the GX7 and now inherited by the GX80, the GX85. Now, if you shoot movies, it's a benefit. If you shoot mostly stills, you'll notice that some of the rival models we'll mention in this review will deliver a bigger image through the viewfinder.
Do you think that most users are going to notice that difference? I mean, I see that overall it's smaller. You know, it's wasted space, which doesn't bother me so much as the fact that the image is a little bit small. But of course, with a camera that's this compact, I'm not expecting a particularly large rear display. But of course, as you said, it's also an issue for the EVF as well.
Well, the interesting thing is that I looked into this a bit further and noticed that the Olympus Pen F, which to be fair is a more expensive higher-end camera, but it is a flat-topped camera that is roughly the same size, manages to squeeze in a 3x2 shaped screen and a 4x3 shaped viewfinder. So for me, the best of both worlds for the viewfinder and the screen. And it's only maybe a couple of millimeters taller, so Olympus has managed to do it, whereas Sony and Panasonic didn't. Now, of course, I may have got this completely wrong. There may be another reason they've employed 16x9 panels. But for me, it's a little bit annoying. As you say, will anyone notice? Probably not, unless they're comparing it side by side with another model. For me, a bigger issue with the viewfinder on the GX80-85, again inherited from the GX7, is the actual panel technology. It is not an OLED panel. It is a field sequential panel. And what that means is that the refresh is different. The way it actually draws the image is different. Now, depending on your eyes, the way your brain works, mine obviously doesn't work the right way, because when I glance across the image on a field sequential panel, I actually see little kind of rainbow artifacts. The image appears to break up a little bit, and it almost makes my eyes tear a bit. Now, if you've ever used any projectors, a similar thing happened with the DLP technology, which reflected light off like a disco mirror ball, really, inside a projector. And I couldn't use those projectors because whenever I looked from one side of the screen to the other, I actually kind of saw how the picture was created. It doesn't affect everyone, but if it does affect you, it's very distracting. Now, I know people who love the viewfinder on this camera and the GX7, but I'm not one of them. So I had to get that out of the way at first. And really, as we'll move on, that is pretty much the only downside I have with this camera. I wish it had an OLED viewfinder and I wish it was squarer in shape. But really, these are things that bother me personally and may not bother you.
Yeah, I shot a little bit with it yesterday. I haven't had much time with the camera, as I mentioned. But it seemed to me that, and this may not be the same as what you're talking about, but I thought that there was a fair amount of flicker in that display. Now, maybe that's a refresh rate issue or a lag issue. But the fact is that I didn't think it was one of the best viewfinders I'd use, certainly.
Yeah, definitely. It's the same thing. I think your eyes are a little bit sensitive to it. And we've also become used to OLED panels, which only a few years ago were real luxury, but now have become pretty much standard. And it's notable that I think pretty much all of the GX80, GX85's rivals use OLED viewfinders. In fact, we've launched into this camera without even talking about pricing and the rivals. Should we get that out of the way now?
Let's talk about the rivals at the end. I think it'd be better. But
okay.
Let me ask you this, though. You mentioned some of the, what would you say, the sort of cutbacks or the limitations of the camera compared to other things that Lumix have on their other cameras. So let's just sort of position it relative to the other ones in the Lumix line. I think you mentioned in your review, your written review, that it has the old 16 megapixel sensor. So tell us a bit about the sensor and what it is relative to some of the other Lumix cameras.
Yes. Now, whenever a Panasonic camera comes out, there's always a lot of discussion on the various forums about which sensor it has, who made it, which generation it is. I have been told, although I've seen conflicting information about this, I've been told that it is the same 16 megapixel Micro Four Thirds sensor that was in the GX7 and therefore also the G7. Now, there is one important difference between them, though. Panasonic has removed the anti-aliasing low-pass filter from that sensor. Now, for those who don't know what that does, digital camera sensors are made up of lots of little squares in a grid pattern, which split the image up into a grid and capture it. Brilliant. Unless the detail is about 1 pixel wide, or just over 1 pixel wide, in which case you can get those shimmering moiré artifacts. Now, to avoid that, the manufacturers or the sensor companies actually put a blurring filter called a low pass or an anti-aliasing filter in front of the sensor to deliberately blur it to get rid of that moiré, make it much less of an issue. But the problem with that is that you're blurring an image, and we're also obsessed with sharpness, sharp lenses, high resolution sensors. It seems ironic that we're chasing that dream on the one hand, but on the other hand, using sensors that have got low pass filters on them. So increasingly there's been a trend to remove these filters. And in fact, the reality is that you think, oh no, my pictures are going to be covered with moiré, everything's going to be shimmering, it's going to look horrible. But the reality is that you hardly notice it in many situations. I never notice it, and I shoot a lot of very fine patterns on architecture, and I haven't heard any of my friends who shoot a lot of, say, textiles and portraits. They don't really moan about it either, so maybe it was less of an issue than we were led to believe. But the fact is, the interesting thing is, the Lumix GX80 or GX85 in North America is the first Lumix D camera to not have an anti-aliasing filter. So it's an old sensor, but without that filter. And Panasonic claim that this allows the pictures to be sharper than before. Now, in my tests, I didn't really notice it being particularly sharper, but certainly I did notice that the pictures looked very, very good. And that was even with the basic kit lens. I was very pleased with the image quality from this model.
You know, I see moiré particularly, well, I run a test I call the screen door test, which is to shoot through a screen door, that fine mesh. If you move back and forth, you can get it just right to make a marvelous moiré pattern. In still images, it's not usually a problem because you can filter it out in Lightroom or Photoshop pretty easily. I think the challenge is more for video, where you can't really go through frame by frame and clean that up, or at least not that I know of. There probably are solutions to it. But I think, as you said, the trend is to get rid of this filter to get that little extra bit of sharpness. I can remember when the D800 came out from Nikon, the D800 and the D800E. I spent more money to get the one without the anti-aliasing filter. But when I ended up comparing them apples to apples, I really had trouble finding the difference.
You're just feigning this here. You know why that Nikon D800D was more expensive. And it wasn't just volumes. Do you know why?
No, I don't.
It's not because it didn't have an anti-aliasing filter. It's that it did have an anti-aliasing filter, but it had another filter in front of it to cancel it out. So you were paying for an extra one. You were paying for one you didn't need and want to get rid of the effect of it. But when they did the D810, they really did get rid of it because there was only one model at that point. So that's what they did. Previously, they had one and it cancelled it out. Now they just don't have one at all. But it's really common now to not have an anti-aliasing filter. I mean, to go back to where it fits in the range, the GX80 or in North America, the GX85, is it's kind of it's not as high end as the GX8, so it's positioned below the GX8, so it's in a mid-range category. It is, in terms of design and style, similar to the G7, but more modern in its feature set. So it's kind of between the G7 and the GX8, I would say. But you were also looking at the G7, it's getting on now. I think that is due an overhaul, and hopefully a lot of the things that we'll talk about that this new model has will end up in a newer version of the G7, because the G7, I think, is a fantastic camera, and compositionally, I prefer it because the screen on the back is fully articulated, whereas on the GX80 85, it only tilts vertically, and it has an OLED viewfinder that's 4x3 shaped, but that's because it's got a viewfinder hump in the middle. Mm-hmm. That extra height allows it to accommodate that bigger viewfinder panel.
Okay, so you mentioned again, I was going to get back to this, that rear LCD on this camera, it does, in fact, tilt up 90 degrees, down maybe 45 degrees if you want to shoot above your head. You can't get it into a selfie mode, and it does not fully articulate. You can't swing it out. So for shooting low, shooting high, it's pretty good.
But in the landscape orientation, obviously, if you turn it 90 degrees in the portrait orientation, those screens that are only articulated on that axis are not that useful unless you're shooting around corners.
That's right. This is the vertical stealthy mode. If you
now, I should note, you know, Doug, I was speaking to some people, especially video shooters, who said, well, you know, you're always going on about how you prefer fully articulated screens. And I was like, yes, of course. They allow you to articulate regardless of the orientation of your picture, and they allow you to do, you know, pieces filmed to camera or self-portraits. And, of course, you can flip it back to face the camera to protect it. So I was feeling all on my high horse, like it was superior in every aspect. But then they pointed out something I hadn't thought about. They said, okay, take your camera with a fully articulated screen. We'll take ours. Now what I want you to do is get it ready to shoot a landscape picture at a low angle, so the screen angled out. Could you do that with yours? Show me what you need to do.
To shoot a landscape picture low, yeah. just like that.
One movement. Now, yes. Could you mime what you would have to do if it were a fully articulated screen?
Well, if it was closed to start with, I'd have to open it up, swivel it, and then it would be hanging out the side of the camera.
Yes. Yes. Now, I don't mind it hanging out the side of the camera because it actually provides more to hold on to. But what it does require is a two-step process. It is slower than one that only tilts vertically. So people who only shoot or mostly shoot in the landscape orientation, which after all is everyone who shoots video, because no one really shoots videos on their side, you naughty phone people, we actually prefer screens that only tilt vertically because they're quicker to action. So I'm not always right.
Not always right. But, you know, you demystified the Nikon D800 for me. That's great. Yes. Even though we prepare for these shows, I always get more out of them than I expected.
And do you not feel bad? You don't feel bad anymore about paying more for it because you got more.
I didn't like the D800, so I'm glad I sold it. It was not at all what the D810 turned out to be, which is a far superior camera. Hey, we talked about the fact that it's touch. What can you do with touch? What are the features that you get out of this? You can obviously touch it.
Yes, you can reposition the AF area with your nose or your finger, depending on which you prefer, which is brilliant. You know, I can't stress how much easier and quicker it is to do this by finger, although it's not necessarily quicker in Doug's demonstration here, but you can really very quickly reposition the AF area. But Panasonic goes, no, you know what, let's do lots of other things with it. So not only can you do that, not only can you tap your way through various menus and settings. Yes, of course you can do that. Of course you can swipe through images and playback, but here's more. There's more besides. There is the ability, which we'll talk about later on in the video, to refocus a picture, rather a video clip, and that is done by touch. You can touch different parts of the screen to refocus on different things in the screen. You can display things like grid lines, but drag them up and down and left and right so that they intersect at exactly the point you want. You can display a live histogram, but what if the histogram's in the way of part of your subject in the corner? Just drag it to another side of the screen. Little things like that just are so useful and show that Panasonic have really thought about how you shoot day to day, you know, moving stuff around. So I'm sure I'll think of some others as we go along, but they really do exploit the touch screen in every possible way. And again, if you don't like it, you can switch it off. So It's not going to get in the way. And there's so many controls on this camera, physical controls. You're not going to compromise it if you compromise the functionality of the camera if you switch it off. I should add that, like the GX7 before it, because it shares much of the same body, it's covered in function keys. Although if you are using the touchscreen, you can get another 5 function buttons, soft function keys, on the right-hand side of the screen. They kind of pull out on a tray and let you select other functions, and they're all customizable. The tray on the side, the touch tray with the soft function keys, also allows you to control various exposure aspects in the movie mode. So you can control things like the shutter speed, the aperture, the ISO, the microphone level, all by touch, silently using the screen. Obviously, if you're banging it with your finger, you're going to hear it, but it's certainly a lot quieter than clicking a control wheel. So yeah, they do a great job with it. I keep saying how it's similar to the GX7, but there are some differences. If you are familiar with the GX7, you'll notice that the ports have actually changed from one side of the body to the other. That's not the interesting thing. The interesting thing is that the ports, which are now in the grip side of the camera, unusually, the USB port can now be used for charging in camera. I think this is the first Lumix G camera that allows in-camera charging over USB. And because it's a fairly fat battery, it does take a couple of hours to fully recharge it, which is quite a long time. But you do have that important ability to top up when you're out and about. And we've discussed this many times, Doug. I love being able to do that either from a port on my laptop, in the car, or with a portable USB battery that I have in my bag. Between shoots, I can top it up and know that I'm good to go afterwards.
Okay, so...
Oh, no microphone input, though. This camera's great for video, but they didn't put a microphone input in it. Naughty Panasonic.
And is there no way through a hot shoe or any other way to get an external mic in?
I don't think so, no. So no. If you're really into video, you'll be shooting with an external recorder like a Zoom H-something-N.
Right. Okay, a couple of other things, then we want to get on to some of the very special features. I do want to mention one thing. You were talking about the touchscreen and all the different things you can do, and I think Panasonic really excels in this. We have many cameras out there that have touchscreens but don't really exploit them to the full extent that Lumix and Panasonic have with this camera. They're continuously, with every camera they come out with, finding new ways to use it. And in a few minutes, we're going to look at some of the most exciting ones. Looking at the notes, I noticed one thing that I maybe didn't expect with a camera in this at this price level, and that's the image stabilization. What did you think of it in this camera?
This is very, very important. Now, one of the differentiators between Panasonic and Olympus bodies in the past, because let's remember they both employed the same Micro Four Thirds standard. They can share lenses. They both have the same size sensors. The big difference in the past was that Olympus would stabilize the sensor within the body, so the sensor would shift around to counteract camera shake. The benefit of that was that it worked with any lens you attached, even ancient adapted lenses. You could dial in the focal length. You didn't even need any electronic contacts, and it would stabilize them very effectively. The only problem with it was that as you go to longer and longer and longer focal lengths, it became less and less effective because there's only so much that the sensor can shift in the body. It can't shift 3 feet to the side. You know, it's only got a limited area. But still, you had to go to some pretty long focal lengths to be able to notice that. Panasonic, on the other hand, traditionally went for optical stabilization in the lens, which is great because it's optimized for that lens. But you need it in every lens you've got it. And that's not much good if you're using Olympus lenses or even some older Panasonic lenses. Some of my favorite lenses for the Micro Four Thirds systems are Lumix lenses that are not stabilized. The Leica Lumix 25mm f1.4, not stabilized. The Lumix G 7-14mm f4, not stabilized. Anyway, so Panasonic, fed up with this criticism, fed up with the GX7, decided to do something about it, and they deployed their first built-in sensor shift stabilization on the GX7. It operated in two axes. Olympus, you could hear them sniggering with their five-axis system. Only two axes? It's not going to pose much of a problem to us. And it didn't. In my test, the GX7 would only, the built-in stabilization only really gave you about one and a half, two stops of stabilization at best. Then with the GX8, they improved it. They got it up to a four-axis system. Again, only really good in my test for about two stops. But importantly, they developed a new technology which said, well, hang on a minute. Most of our lenses have got optical stabilization. This camera's got sensor shift stabilization. Is there some way we could combine it rather than just choosing one or the other, or worse, have them both running at the same time and counteracting each other? So they came up with this technology called Dual IS. It needs a compatible Lumix G lens with optical stabilization. But if you do have one of those lenses, one of the more modern ones, then the camera can exploit the sensor shift stabilization and the optical stabilization in the lens at the same time and produce a more stabilized image. And in my test, it is certainly more effective, but still it was testament to how good models like the OMD EM1 and especially the EM5 Mark II are from Olympus, that their built-in body-based stabilization alone was still superior in most regards. Panasonic has plugged on with it, though, and the GX80 or GX85 now features their latest built-in stabilization, their third generation. It now operates in five axes, and it is much improved. That final fifth axis is a rotational one, and it must be the way that I shake. I must hold the camera like this and go, oh, that's my coffee shake. It's a rotational shake, you see. It's not a up, down, left or right shake. It's a rotational shake. Because in my test, it performed much better than those earlier models. In fact, it came really, really close to the OMD EM1 with unstabilized Olympus lenses. The view was very, very steady when you were composing, not quite as eerily steady as the Olympus, but so close, you need them side by side to really see that difference. When I was taking pictures with them, I was easily getting 3 to 4 stops of compensation. This is with unstabilized lenses. The Olympus was still about a stop better, but then when you fit a dual IS compatible lens, a Panasonic lens with built-in stabilization, that gave me an extra stop or so, bringing it in line with the Olympus. Now, of course, the Olympus can't exploit that technology, the dual, apart from on one of its own lenses, a 300mm f4. And when I fitted a Lumix GOIS lens, which was dual IS compatible, it actually slightly surpassed the performance I was getting from the Olympus. So to boil that down, in some situations, it's almost as good. In some, it's as good. And in some, it's even a little bit better. And considering how good that Olympus stabilization is, this is a massive deal. This is such a big deal for Panasonic that they finally just about got there with the GX80, GX85. And I really hope that they take it out of the GX line and start putting it on the GH line, the GM series, the single-digit G series. I want to see this on all their cameras because it's now refined to a point where it works extremely well. It really helps with your composition. It really lets you handhold at very slow shutter speeds. And crucially, it works when you're filming video, even 4K video. And you might go, what about overheating? Built-in stabilization and 4K video on that small body? Not a problem. I recorded 3 half-hour clips, 4K clips with stabilization in a row, an hour and a half's worth of video. And not only was there still a little bit of charge remaining on the battery, but it had not overheated. Yes, the body was very warm, but it had not overheated. And if you look now at cameras that have built-in stabilization and 4K video, it's a very small club, really, with Sony as the other member. And models like the A7R Mark II and the A7S Mark II will film 4K internally and have built-in stabilization. But I personally found their built-in stabilization much less effective. Now, of course, their sensor is 4 times bigger, so they can shoot at higher ISOs if necessary. But for video, where you're generally shooting at a fixed shutter speed, having that better stabilization is really helpful. So with the GX80, GX85, even though it's a mid-range product, there's a lot of filmmakers who will, on the one hand, curse Panasonic for not fitting a microphone input and not having the Cinelite D or V profiles for flat output. You can use the natural profile, which is, you know, kind of acceptable. But they'll love it for the video quality. They'll love it for the built-in stabilization.
Yeah, very good. It's one of the things that I find when I test. I don't shoot much video for myself except for the reviews, but I find that it always surprises me when I start a slow tilt or a slow pan and the camera says, no, you don't, and it'll hold off. So you move the camera and then it finally gets the idea that you're really doing this intentionally and then it'll catch up with you. And one of the differences is how well the camera smooths out that transition from being still to accepting the fact that you're doing a pan or a tilt. And all of them are doing quite good. Which I've always said that some of that best Olympus stabilization is spooky good. And it does remind you that it's trying to hold steady even when you're not.
Now, a lot of people have commented on my video clips that I've posted already from the GX80, 85, that when I've been panning horizontally, there is that catch-up, which doesn't look very good. That's because I've got all the stabilization enabled. There is a mode on this camera where you can go for a panning mode for stabilization, where you can effectively turn off the horizontal. So there may be some shake, but at least you don't have that kind of catching up and compensating as you pan. I should also mention that another one of the really clever modes that Panasonic has, and this should probably segue us into video afterwards, is it has this thing called live crop. Now, if you're filming in 4K, you're actually capturing a frame that's effectively four 1080p frames arranged in a square. What this means is that you can crop a 1080p frame out of it without any loss of quality and effectively move it around. You know, you can crop from any portion of it. And Panasonic's engineers thought, wait a minute, we could do something clever with this. So the live crop mode, which was shown on some compact cameras earlier, effectively lets you draw a frame on the screen with your finger. You can actually resize it and position a starting point. So you could have it, say, on the left-hand side of the frame. And then it says, where do you want it to end up in 30 seconds time? And you say, I want it to end up over here. And what happens is it records a 1080p frame that moves across the image completely smoothly. So even though the camera's static, it's exploiting that 4K capture to move a 1080p frame across and produce a perfectly smooth pan. You can also incorporate that, or instead, with a zoom. So you can go from a full frame that's scaled down to about two times, because that's effectively what the crop is doing. It's a little bit different from that, but approximately two times. So you can combine a two times digital zoom with a pan in any direction, and you basically set it up, and you say, that's what I want it to do, go. And it does it all in camera. So even if you're not traveling with a fluid head, you know, you can still end up with very smooth pans and zooms all in camera. And again, it uses the touchscreen to do it. So it's very clever stuff.
It's like an enhanced and controllable version of the Ken Burns effect that we've seen on some of those things. Doesn't Apple call it the Ken Burns effect, something like that? You know, the images sort of slowly zooming in and out and sliding around. Anyway, all right, enough of that. Hey, we're going to talk quickly about video, and then I want to go quickly into some of the really unique features, particularly having to do with using video for the purpose of shooting 4K here. You mentioned video. You mentioned the lack of the microphone input. What are the video modes that it supports?
Yeah, so it doesn't have a mic input, and it doesn't have CineLike D or V, which are the flat profiles you'll find on the high-rem models. But apart from that, it does pretty much everything that you would find on those higher-end Lumix bodies. As such, you can film 4K video in 24, 25, or 30p, depending on your region. You can film 1080 at up to 60p. There's nothing faster on this model, so there's no slow motion unless you want to take a 60p file and reduce it to, say, 24 on a timeline. So that's lacking on this. But lest we forget, it is a mid-range model. It's not supposed to be offering 120 frames per second at this price point. So those are the video modes. You've got full control over the exposure. As I mentioned earlier, you can control that while you film, even silently using the touch screen if you like. There is an awful lot of control that you have over the video here. I should say you can also use the touch screen, as you could on earlier models, to pull focus between something that's distant and something that's nearby. And unlike Sony's cameras, which pull focus basically whenever they feel like it, if you've got it switched on, the nice thing about the Lumix models is they pull focus when you tell them. So either when you tap the screen or when you move it and you half press the shutter, it will only refocus them. I should also say that it makes better use of the DFD lens profiling technology that Panasonic's been doing on its own Lumix G lenses, primarily to help it continuously autofocus better for stills, you know, in action scenarios when something's coming towards you. And I should say that the GX80, GX85 does autofocus much better in a continuous shooting environment. I know I've just left video for a minute there, but I'm going to come back to video and say you can really see it on those video clips. Not always, but sometimes if the environment is correct and the lens is correct, it will pull focus and stop when you want it to, actually on the subject. Whereas previously, as a contrast-based system, it would have to go beyond a little bit, pull itself back, and then slowly wobble until it found it. The old familiar contrast-based hunting process. It's still there with some lenses. It's still there in some situations on this camera, but in others, especially with the kit zoom, the 12 to 32 kit zoom that most people will be buying it with, it can rack very convincingly. And I've got some video examples of that at CameraLabs.com. It really does go back and forth, and it stops. It doesn't hunt or wobble.
Well, good. While we're talking about focus, let's transition back to stills, or this whole idea that we've been working with for about a year now, the idea of shooting video for the purpose of extracting still images. And Panasonic has come out with some I think they're new features in this model. I don't know, but this one called Post Focus.
The whole idea, which is brilliant, is that since the beginning of time, you've been able to extract stills from video. Because, of course, video is capturing, say, in the American regions, 30 frames per second. That is a lot of frames per second. But with 1080p, the resolution was always low. 1080p, believe it or not, full HD is only about 2 megapixels worth. No one wants a 2 megapixel picture. But with 4K video, when you grab a still from it, it's an 8 megapixel picture. Now, that's still not ultra high resolution, but it's good enough for a lot of people. And remember, it's effectively allowing you to capture 30 of these a second, 38 megapixel pictures per second. So Panasonic's engineers again went away and had the thing and went, what can we do with this? The first thing they came up with, which we've seen on several cameras before, but we're going to demo it again because it's so interesting, is 4K photo. This is basically just recording 4K video, but providing a really nice interface on the screen to let you subsequently subtract the decisive moment. And I filmed a couple of clips around Brighton, which hopefully you can show, Doug. Do you want to do the bird taking off or the jet ski?
Let's go to the bird here.
Okay, now I filmed both of these clips using the pre 4K photo mode. What this does is constantly buffers a second's worth of footage so that when you press the button to say, right, I want to start recording, it records the last second that it's already got and the second following. So you press the button when the action has taken place. In this case, I had the camera pointing at a bird, just waiting for it to take off. And the instant it lifted off, I pressed the button because I knew that the camera had already recorded the previous second when the bird was still stationary. So Doug, can you show us that sequence? So what happens, this shows you the image of the bird, and you can see there, when Doug presses the left and right buttons, you can see it take off. And if he presses this button, yeah, it goes all the way back and you can see it landing. And then you just go back and forth until you find the picture that you want. So if you tap it back, keep going, stop, stop, stop. That's it, how about that one? And then you just press the button in the middle and it says, do you want to save this image? And you say yes, and it will export that as an 8 megapixel JPEG. No, it is not a RAW file. You can't do anything like that with it, but it does let you capture that decisive moment. And in this instance, it was after it had actually flown off. So that in itself is really neat. But they've gone even further this time. They have a post-focus mode that was introduced, I think, on an FZ model and subsequently deployed on some firmware upgrades. So it has been seen before, but I don't think we've demonstrated it on All About the Gear. So let's show it. Now, what this does is it uses video to basically take a picture at all of the AF areas on the screen. So if you imagine, it cycles very quickly through all the AF areas, refocusing for each one. So each video frame shows a different part of the image in focus. And it takes, depending on the lens and depending on how close and far the subject is, it takes about 2 to 3 or 4 or 5 seconds to capture it. But it lets you do something very clever. So are you now in the correct mode, Doug?
Watch this.
So if you have a look, Doug is tapping the screen, and look, he's now refocusing on the back of that. But what if we want the front? Just tap it, and now we've got the front in focus. Now, this is a very shallow depth of field shot that I shot with the Olympus 75mm f1.8 at f1.8. Now, Panasonic, originally, when this technology came out, said that you need a DFD-profiled Lumix lens for it to work. But here it is working with an Olympus lens, which isn't profiled. And yes, the process did take about 4 or 5 seconds to capture. So you do have to keep the camera fairly still, although it was handheld in this example. And it's just so, it's almost like magic. It's like the Lytro light field technology. Now, that really does let you refocus after the event. This is just really a clever interface for playing back video. Remember, it is just a 2 or 3 second video file that racks focus from near to far. But the clever thing is how it ties into their user interface, the way that you can tap anywhere on the screen, it lets you do it. Here's a picture of me. Oh, no, it's not in focus. What can we do? Tap the eye. It is in focus. Actually, I want the other eye in focus. Tap that, and now that one goes in focus. So you can go between them. Now, you'll notice that Doug couldn't exactly position the AF area over my eye, and that's because the camera is only capturing fixed areas. So if the point that you want in focus is actually just away from that, you're not going to be able to tap it exactly. But even in that scenario with the eyes, I managed to extract two images, again, very shallow depth of field, where I had either my left eye or my right eye in sharp focus. And this is brilliant because, yes, the picture did take a couple of seconds to capture, but you've forgotten that when you're playing it back. And when you're playing it back, you're going, look at this. I can change the focus just by tapping the screen. It's magic. It's like some kind of science fiction technology. But really, again, it's just a very clever media player for 4K video. But and again, what Doug didn't show there is that when you do have the thing in focus, and you may have also noticed focus peaking, outlining stuff, highlighting the areas that are in focus so you could see which eye it was over, which post it was over. So that helps you judge it, or you can magnify the image. Once you're ready, press the button in the middle and it exports it as a new 8-megapixel JPEG file. I think it's brilliant. You know, there's so many features in these cameras that writing an in-depth review of one of them just takes forever because there's just so much stuff to talk about.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And these two new modes, I think, really are terrific.
They've also got a new mode, which is new on this camera, called Light Composite or Composite, which works like one of the, well, produces an effect similar to one we've seen on Olympus cameras before, where if you're doing light painting or you're capturing fireworks, one of the problems is that if you're leaving the camera exposed for long enough to capture somebody writing, I think Doug is wonderful, you know, it takes ages to write that, you might overexpose a portion of the background. Similarly, if you want lots of fireworks bursts, suddenly the ground or a building may become too overexposed. So the light composite mode recognizes that and says, well, you know what? That bit over there has had enough exposure. Let's leave that bit. Let's only record new stuff on the picture. And this, again, works differently to the Olympus one. The way it works on the Panasonic is it, again, exploits 4K video. It's actually using a video file to create a composite of different frames. But again, very clever. They've got this technology. They're really good at doing 4K video. So they're thinking, how can we use it? What else can we do with it?
Yeah, very interesting. These cameras are great for people who do want to experiment with these modes. Of course, it makes good pictures as well. But if you really want to exploit some of the technology, it is a lot of fun to play with. I want to go on and wrap up by talking about some of the competitors. Before I do that, though, this camera typically comes with a kit lens, a 12 to 32 millimeter, which is a full frame equivalent of a 24 to 64, almost a 24 to 70. What do you think of this lens, Gordon?
Okay, so it's a collapsing kit zoom. It's one of the ones where you have to kind of twist it open to start off with. Maybe you could demonstrate that. So close it completely. That's it in its travel configuration. And then if you twist it to the 12 millimeter, that's it at 12, and then you go all the way to 32. So when it's collapsed, it is a pretty compact lens. Now, all the manufacturers now offer these collapsing kit zooms, and there are inevitably some optical compromises as a result. It's not as good as Panasonic's older 14 to 42 millimeter, but it is about a third of the length. And it's not bad. I have to say, I've got a lot of sample images. If you want to have a look for yourself, go to cameralabs.com. I think we'll feature some of them on the All About the Gear page as well. And you'll see that the image quality is very good even with this lens. I also got to test it with a ton of other lenses. I should mention before actually moving on with the rivals, I just wanted to mention that we have talked a lot about all this new technology that's in this camera, but Panasonic has also gone back and thought about still images and how people are taking them these days. And there's a trend for really high contrast, very attractively rendered black and white images at the moment. Fujifilm has been very good at it. For a while, it's got its new Acros simulation on the X-Pro2. Olympus has had some great simulations as well. Panasonic now has an L monochrome picture style that is a high contrast black and white effect that looks really, really good. Like a lot of them, you can apply a digital red filter and other filters. I use the red filter to darken blue skies. It looks really, really nice. And I should also mention that it now additionally does focus bracketing as well as aperture bracketing. I'm not sure why you'd want aperture bracketing, but focus bracketing is very useful for focus stacking, which is when you take a macro picture of something and you think, well, I can either focus on the stuff nearby or far off, but I can't get them both in focus. Even if I close the aperture Chit F22, I still can't get the required depth of field, and now diffraction's knackered the image and it looks rubbish. With focus stacking or focus bracketing, you can get it to focus in lots of different steps from near to far, and then use software like Helicon Focus afterwards to stack them all together into one picture with a very large dynamic field, even in a macro environment. I tried it, it works. Again, another nice feature on this camera. But now let's go back to the rivals. Sorry for that little interruption, but I knew that we'd get to the end and we'd forget about it, and they're really important features.
Well, very good. So this camera with this kit zoom is US $800. What's the price in the UK?
It's £599, so £600 in the UK with the 12-32mm kit zoom. So that's why it fits into that mid-range category.
Okay, so we have, in the Lumix line, we've got the G7 at $600, a camera we've compared it to on and off during this review, right?
Yep, doesn't have built-in stabilization, but does have the better viewfinder and the fully articulated screen. I would hope that a new version of this camera would come soon that has stabilization and the other benefits of this model, right. I hope.
And if we stay in the Micro Four Thirds world, we've got the OMD EM10 Mark II at $600, also with a kit lens, so it's $200 less.
Yeah, the EM10 Mark II is a fantastic camera, and it still has that fantastic built-in stabilization, nice viewfinder, lovely retro style and controls. It does not do 4K video, and while it has a wealth of its own clever modes, it doesn't have those 4K photo modes and post-focus that we looked at on the Panasonic, but it's definitely a big contender and good value now because it's not that newer product.
Yeah, I think this continues the trend of Olympus sometimes being superior for still image photography, but Panasonic, because of their heritage, typically excelling in the areas of video or adapting video to other applications, right?
Yeah, but it is nice to see. While I do prefer the controls on the Olympus, I didn't really get to mention them in the review on the GX80-85 when we were discussing it. The dials didn't quite do it for me. They weren't quite tactile enough, didn't provide the right kind of positive feedback. Very personal choice. I do prefer the Olympus controls, but there's so much on this Panasonic camera to like. There is a lot. So yeah, the EM10 Mark II is a contender. Also, Fuji's X-T10. How much does that go for now?
That's 900 US, so it's a touch more than this one. Good camera, though.
If we keep going up in price, we reach models like Sony's A6300 and the Olympus Pen F, both flat-topped cameras. How much do they go for?
Well, the 6300 is $1,150, and the Pen F is another $50, $1,200 US. So they're crossing the $1,000 threshold with the kit lens.
Well, does that Pen F
price include
the kit?
No, you're right. The Pen F is $1,200 just for the body. The 6300 comes with a kit lens, one of which I think neither of us are particularly pleased with, but that's where it comes in. I think the 6300 is about $1,000 with no lens.
Yeah, so both those products are much higher end in price. But in terms of a lot of features, now some of them have got some benefits. I mean, the Pen F, the Olympus has packed all of their technology into it, and it's a beautiful little camera, but it is quite an expensive camera. The A6300 shoots faster, continuously autofocuses better. It's got some weatherproofing on it, but ergonomically, I don't think it's fantastic. Obviously, it shoots 4K video, doesn't have built-in stabilization. So it's quite an expensive camera for what it does compared to the Panasonic. When you look at the Panasonic with its stabilization and 4K video, for the money, it's a very, very strong product. And certainly while I was reviewing it, when I review a camera, I tease, I guess. I release sample videos and sample pictures. And it's interesting to judge the feedback that you get from people. Can we do more of this? Can you have more of that? And I got an awful lot of interest in the GX80, GX85 as I've released more and more information on it. It's a very popular camera already. People are very interested in it. And I think price-wise, it's a very, very compelling price for its feature set. We should also mention the A6000, another flat top, the old flat top Sony. Still great value, still your best choice at that price point if you're into shooting action at high speed. But, you know, I don't want to use the word kudos. Respect, whatever you want to say. Well done, Panasonic, for actually making its continuous AF the best I've seen on any of its models to date. Still not as good as the Sony for very high speed stuff, but I managed to capture a lot of action with this camera. A lot of action, a lot that I couldn't capture before, even with the new 100 to 400 millimeter zoom. So at 400 millimeter, that's like shooting at 800 millimeter equivalent. And it could auto focus that on cyclists coming towards me, the jet skis. I even got pictures of birds in flight, as you'll see in my review. And, you know, this camera is very capable, especially for its price point.
Now, it sounds like you like the camera quite a bit. In the few hours I had to spend with it, I was impressed with it. It certainly seems to me like it's an excellent starter camera for the Micro Four Thirds world, although, again, the EM10 Mark II is also a superb starter camera, or, as we sometimes say, a second camera. If you're going on a trip, you want to have a backup camera, you have a higher-end Micro Four Thirds camera, want to be able to use all the lenses, you have a spouse or significant other who wants to carry a camera, or you want them to carry your spare camera, that's the way to do it. So sounds like you like it overall, though, yes?
Yeah, definitely. And even though I'm not personally a fan of the style of flat-top cameras, and even though I didn't get on with the electronic viewfinder in it, I still think it's a fantastic camera, and it tantalizingly points us towards a possible future of a G8 or a GH5. I have no advanced information on either of these products, but I'm guessing that one or both should be surely due for an update at some point in the next year. And to have a GH4 with built-in stabilization or a G7 with built-in stabilization and all of those other modern features we mentioned, that would be, for me, a very, very, very nice camera.
Yeah, we want people to continue the thought that they might put all the features into one camera rather than having one model that excels at this and another excels at that. Come on. Put it all together. We'll pay the price. Give us everything at once. Okay, Gordon, thank you very much. I want to mention to everybody that if you want to, you know, we've gone on for a whole hour here, but if you want to know even more about the GX85 or even the GX80, please go to cameralabs.com. And if you want to buy something, click on the buy now links. It pays the bills. Gordon, thank you once again for a terrific review.
You're very welcome, Doug. It's always a pleasure to talk about these. It was a very brief little discussion we had on it there. You wait until you see the written version. That's where I really go into the detail.
I understand. I'm going to need to take a day off. Gordon, thanks once again. Thanks to everybody for watching and listening, and we'll see you next time on All About the Gear.